You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 310.
On today's show, we have our inaugural episode of Strat Chat, where we talk about three pivotal events in the history of the fun.
Let's dig a little deeper. Find that gold for those strats. Yes. Strats of gold.
Yes. You do need to actually dig deeper, though, to like get to the earlier stuff.
You do have to dig deeper.
Yeah.
The whole thing of Strat Chat is just dig a little deeper.
It is. Just keep going.
So now we have to come up with a new tagline for the rest of the show.
Okay.
Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello.
So we're premiering a new, theme today. I guess it's a theme.
Yeah, or like a mini.
Not mini. It's full size. Okay, so while we're probably going to cut most of that out, we probably didn't. But anyway, so we're premiering this new thing today. It's very similar to series. Timelines.
Mini series. That's what I was trying to come up with.
Okay.
So now you have to leave all that in, too.
Okay, great. So a new mini series, although there's only one of them, and there's not going to be another one next week.
Well, there won't be, but there will be more in the future.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like timelines. We'll set one up and then go 6 months without doing another one. So,
well, they do take more research and also like inspiration for, whatever the topic is going to be. So,
right. So to get people up to speed here, timelines episodes, we talk about like an anchor event, like the building of the pyramids or Easter Island or something like that. It's not really an event, but a culture or something people know about.
Yeah.
And then we say, okay, great. So we have that thing that you know about, and then other two more things that maybe are less well known, but still super cool, just to talk about, hey, at the same time in the world, this was also happening.
Yeah. You know? It's really interesting to look at what was happening at the same time around the world, because you really see like where different cultures are in their development and whatever.
Right.
But that being said, we had the inspiration to kind of look at sort of the complete opposite of that, right?
Sort of. We just inverted it 90 degrees. We rotated it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Because like there have been human occupations at different times in the same place all around the world too.
Yeah.
And we always joke about how like in England, they just like blow through all like the medieval stuff to get and blow through the Roman stuff to get to the prehistoric stuff below that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not actually true because plenty of people are interested in the upper layers, too. But it's kind of like that. So we thought we would call this series the Strat Chat.
Yep.
Where we take a slice of stratigraphy and look at all the different occupations of that place by different peoples through time.
Yeah. And we were inspired by this when we visited the Yukon Beringia Interpretive Center.
Yes.
And there's an episode about that, which we'll link to. Mm-hmm. That was just a few episodes ago.
Episode 308, actually. So, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll have that in the show notes, along with a ton of references for what we're about to talk about in the show notes, by the way. Mm-hmm. A lot of stuff to go over there. So head over to just your notes down in your player right there, and you can either go to our website or you can view the notes right there. So anyway, so we're going to talk about the Yukon, layers of Yukon history.
Yeah, and just so that we make sure we define this, but stratigraphy, like what does that word mean?
Yeah.
And what is it?
I mean, so geologically, stratigraphy is just different layers of soil, basically, of material, rock, things like that. Soil is a very loaded term because not everything is soil, but different geological layers, basically. Right. That's what stratigraphy is. But stratigraphy can also be just layers of kind of anything, really. Mm-hmm. Like we always look at like a cake or something like that say, man, look at that stratigraphy.
Yes.
Like those crazy cakes they make over in England on the Bake Off that have like 98 layers.
Right, something like that.
They're just like, oh my God. So anyway, so stratigraphy, it's just layers through time. So we're going to look at one place and that's basically going to be the Yukon, which is a big place.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked out sort of an overall early Yukon, and then a really big people lived in the Yukon, the first people that were there and how they did. And then another sort of big event that took place in the Yukon. We're going to talk about all three of those.
Yeah. And I'm sure as we do more episodes of Strat Chat, we'll find places where you actually have literal occupation of different people throughout time at the same site. But in this case, because the Yukon is so big, there's and doesn't have that many people, really, not compared to the size. We sort of looked at the area as a whole, and we found a really cool site that we're going to talk about in segment two. And then another really cool, like, I guess you could call it occupation that happened later for segment three. Mm-hmm. So, but in this first segment, what we kind of want to talk about is just, well, how people got to the Yukon. Like, what happened to set it up so that people could occupy the Yukon?
Right.
Yeah.
It really is the whole geology of the Yukon almost before people got there, right?
Yeah.
Which is what you're talking about. So, yeah. And that all has to do with the last ice age, which was a worldwide event. Over here in this, well, the ice age in general lasted around the world from about 110,000 to about 11,700 years ago. Of course, locally, that could have been different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
ice was around longer in time periods. The weather changed in, you know, quicker someplace. Well, the climate, I should say. Weather is daily. Climate is
over big.
Time. Yeah, yeah. Over time. So the climate would have changed at different rates in different areas. Right. But in general, you can kind of say 110,000 to about 11,700 years ago. There's a reason for that. We'll talk about it in a second here. But the last glacial maximum, because during that time period, glaciers ebbed and flowed, right? It got warmer, got colder, got warmer, got colder. It wasn't just frozen the whole time. Well, it kind of was, but not completely.
Yeah.
But the last glacial maximum, the point where the glaciers were at their furthest extent, and again, glaciers move real slowly, so this is a long period of time, is between 26,500 and 19,000 years ago. And again, that's around the world.
Yeah.
Right. They call it the LGM. You actually see that in different publications and stuff like that, the last glacial maximum. It's a big foundational event. You know, Neanderthals and our human ancestors lived through it. Anyway, the end of the last glacial period, like I said, was about 11,700 years ago. And the reason why that number is significant, it's, like I said, probably an average number around the world. But that is the end officially of the Pleistocene epoch and the start of the Holocene epoch.
Yeah.
And the Holocene, well, the Holocene is what we were in up until we redefined it
to the Anthropocene.
Now we're technically in the Anthropocene, although some people kind of don't want it to be the Anthropocene.
There's still conversations about around that, I believe. But
to get into that just a little bit, I believe the Anthropocene starts in the late 1800s, early 1900s, but it's basically when you can start seeing the effect of human behavior on the landscape.
And
it really is just like carbon emissions and factory emissions and things like that showing up in the soil. Showing up in rock layers.
For sure.
You know, this has to be a datable layer that you can see. That's what makes a new epic. So anyway, well, that's one of the things.
So the Yukon was covered partially in the southern and eastern areas by the Cordilleran ice sheet. And it flowed into the Yukon from the mountains to the west and south and from the east. The Cordilleran ice sheet caused the Yukon River to reverse its flow, and that created the glacial Lake Yukon. So much of this area up here was under ice, underwater, and the landscape that we see today is was carved out by those interactions between ice and water and all that.
Yeah, it's actually kind of cool because when the ice sheet thawed, basically, started to thaw and started to drain, it created that glacial lake, which was stopped up by ice flows and silts and things like that. And then it just let go. Catastrophically. And it created basically a lot of the landscape that is around Whitehorse, which is the capital of the Yukon, and a whole bunch of areas around there. Incidentally, we learned that the same thing happened probably around the world in lots of different places, but the same thing happens in the Columbia Plateau of Eastern Washington.
There was a big
glacial lake in the mountains there. I guess that's the, is that the Rockies, right? I don't think that's the Rockies, right next to like Idaho. I know it's the Rockies further in, but like right at Coeur d'Alene, Idaho there, it was all stopped up and opened up and basically carved out the entire Columbia Plateau in just a short period of time.
Pretty common geological thing to happen, I think, is these areas, they get stopped up, but they don't stay that way forever. And then all of a sudden there's a big release and it creates like a super dramatic landscape, essentially.
Something interesting to note, too, is that northern and central Yukon remained largely ice-free during this whole LGM period. And never had ice on top of it, which, to be honest, I mean, I've learned about the ice-free corridor, and I've learned about, you know, people living up here and Beringia and all this stuff throughout my whole archaeological career. Mm-hmm. And I never really thought of different parts of land actually being ice-free unless they were like mountaintops.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I figured even those had glaciers on them, but
well, yeah, probably, you know, or so most.
Yeah.
I mean, just that's what we've learned being here in Alaska is that these mountains, I mean, with the exception of Denali, most of them are not even that mm-hmm. tall. Like the ones over in the Seward area were like 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet. Like that's nothing compared to the Rockies.
Rich, if you're living on the East Coast of the United States right now going, oh my God, that's so tall. That's right. Cause you don't have mountains.
Well, no. Okay. Leave the Appalachians
alone.
Send
the hate mail.
They're fine. But, you know, like that's nothing compared to the Rockies and the Sierras. Yeah. Those are all much taller. But because we're so far north and we've got the Arctic climate up here, mm-hmm. they are covered in snow. You know,
we're still surrounded by.
Yeah, we're still surrounded by snow. It's
the weekend after the 4th of July. So it's a few days after that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first week of July, and we're surrounded by snow covered mountains still.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So. It's just different up here in this Arctic or subarctic, you know, mm-hmm. landscape.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But just knowing that a whole bunch of those areas, not a whole bunch, but a large area was largely ice free is really important to understand for the existence of animals mm-hmm. and for the eventual existence of humans and the migration of humans into the area.
Yeah. Right? So super important, because what we're getting to is that how and why people ended up over here.
Yeah.
Sort of setting the stage for future occupations of this area. And the animals that lived here are a super important part of that picture. Yeah.
So animals that lived in the area during the last ice age and still survive here today, probably changed a little bit through evolution, is the muskox, a little bit of note on those guys later, the caribou, mountain sheep, brown bears, and wolves. So they were all here during that time and lived through it and are still here today.
Yep.
Other animals that arrived in the Yukon as the ice age was ending include moose, elk, and of course humans. And I know elk came from Iberia. I think moose may have as well, along with the humans. And humans, I actually read a paper, and I don't think we talk about it too much, but I read a paper doing the research for this talking about how the elk migration actually across Beringia, when they could do that, influenced when humans could do that as well, because mm-hmm. obviously they're following food resources and things like that. But it wasn't good elk habitat for a really long time because it was all swampy and wet.
Yeah,
and it just like
they don't love that.
Yeah, it wasn't awesome. Yeah. So anyway, a note on the muskox. They actually died out in the 1800s. And what I read didn't say why, but they were reintroduced later. So all the muskox that are wild up here now are actually descendants of the reintroduced muskox.
I wonder if that was hunting by European.
Who knows?
Europeans, maybe.
Yeah, there was a big fur trade. And I don't know if their fur is. And I think it's
muskox is super soft. Yeah.
Animals that didn't make the ice age as it ended and a little bit beyond, of course, were the woolly mammoths and mastodons and horses, lions, and short faced bears.
Right.
Yeah. That was all. See, listen to our Beringia episode for our Beringia Interpretive Center episode for more on that.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But the presence of all these animals in this area made it so that humans were following them, basically. Mm-hmm. They came over from Siberia on the, you know, through the ice-free corridor, which turns out probably had a lot more sections of ice-freeness than you kind of think of. So that brought them over, and it sort of set the stage for the entire, you know, peopling of North and South America, which is crazy.
All right. And we're going to talk about that, the first people that came in here, on the other side of the break, back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 310. And if we did redo that intro, welcome back to Strat Chat.
Strat Chat. I feel like we need like a sound for it or something.
I know. We need a song. Can somebody do us a jingle?
Oh my God.
We need in a wave format. Just send it over. That'd be great. Strat Chat. Oh my God. So, okay. We're going to talk some dates here, but dates are always basically what we have right now, and mm-hmm. there could be something that is found that's older. But when people have dates, they tend to speak in very absolute terms, but it doesn't mm-hmm. necessarily mean absolute things. That's just the way science is.
Yeah.
You know?
It's the earliest evidence for something, but it doesn't mean the earliest existence. You can't ever really say that this is 100% for sure the earliest, because...
No, and nobody even means that, but they will say, oh, you know, people arrived in this area at exactly at this date.
Yeah.
But they will immediately change their minds and change that date should new evidence arise.
Right.
That's just how you got
to
learn.
Well, that's how it has to be. That's how science goes.
Yeah. So anyway, the first people in the Yukon, migrated from Asia near the end of the Ice Age around 15,000 years ago. Now, that was a few thousand years before the official end of the Ice Age, so it was still icy and cold.
Chilly. Yeah. But these
chilly
are
up here now.
The people who migrated were well adapted to that climate because they're coming from, you know, Siberia and places that are super cold. So, you know, coming over here, over to Alaska and then the Yukon would have been kind of exactly what they were used to.
Yeah. You know? They had to get here a few thousand years early because they had reservations to see those bears at Brooks Falls, which you got to get reservations at least 2,000 years in advance.
Oh my God, that's ridiculous.
Yes.
That's ridiculous. So,
anyway, so there's ongoing scientific debate about the timing, of course, but the current consensus supports this time frame. New things are found.
Yeah.
But we're thinking in general, it's around that time frame that people started showing up.
Yep.
All right.
So there's multiple lines of evidence. We've got genetic, linguistic, and archaeological evidence that supports the Asian origin and migration routes. And DNA and blood type similarities link indigenous peoples of the Americans of the Americas to populations in Asia. There's been a lot of work around that, I think, actually, and particularly in the last like decade or two, because people are trying, you know, North American researchers want to show the roots of the people that occupied, you know, this part of the world. So the DNA research, as it gets better and better, is one really great way to do that.
Yeah, it's kind of cool, all the DNA mixing, because they've got ancient DNA from Siberia at a place called the Malta site, and it's M-A-L apostrophe T-A, so I'm probably not pronouncing that right. But that was about 24,000 years ago, and that site shows mixing between European and Asian peoples before migration across the Bering Land Bridge.
Yeah, yeah, so that's super interesting, right? So European DNA was introduced 24,000 years ago, at least, in and then brought across the Bering Land Bridge.
Yeah.
Where it developed into, you know, the populations that we have today before, you know, 24,000 years later, the Europeans come to North America from the other direction. And then there's like more mixing between the populations.
More mixing.
Yeah.
People like to mix.
It's so crazy how human people and genetics work. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And then there's DNA from a 13,000-year-old Clovis burial in Montana that connects these early migrants to later First Nations peoples. So also forgot to mention in Canada, you know, we call the indigenous population here in the United States Native Americans. In Canada, they're called First Nations or First Peoples.
Right.
So, but basically the same thing. It's just different ways to call them.
Yes.
The linguistic similarities that you mentioned still exist between Siberian indigenous languages and those spoken in the Yukon today, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. I wasn't aware of that, but of course it makes sense, right? Yeah, that's super cool. The Yana River site in northern Siberia has evidence of human presence around 35,000 years ago, and that includes bone and stone tools. And then technological advancements such as warm clothing and shelter were crucial for survival and migration into the Arctic.
Yeah.
Like I was saying, they had to have those things in order to even come across. So people that were adjusted to Siberia and what the weather was like there, basically, would be well suited to come over to this side of the world and just basically they wouldn't even know they were crossing any boundaries or any they weren't crossing any boundaries. Not not 15,000 years ago or whatever. They were just moving around like people do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's even evidence of burnt bone in ancient campfires on that side showing adaptation to harsh, treeless environments. So nothing new, really. All of the elk.
Yeah. Right.
Yep. So small groups gradually migrated across Eurasia into Beringia and North America. And again, if they're just moving and following, I mean, generation to generation, they some that didn't live exactly in that spot probably wouldn't even have noticed because it happened so gradually, the development of this new landmass. You know what I mean? I mean, obviously, there's people that would have lived near there going, hey, in our oral history, we have nothing about what the hell's over there. That used to be water, you know, but I feel like if people are moving around and moving into the area, if you're new to the area, you would have just, you wouldn't have known that was water. You would just keep on trucking.
Right.
Before you know it, you're in North America.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yep.
Humans reached the southern tip of South America a few hundred years after arriving in North America.
That seems unlikely.
Which does not seem long enough.
I don't buy that. Personally, I think there's other theories that people arrived in South America from by other means. I mean, there's definitely people that did cross, well, descendants of people that crossed the Bering Land Bridge and then came down, lived in this whole area, First Nations peoples, Native Americans, and eventually did make it down to South mm-hmm. America, right? There's definitely genetic evidence to support yeah. that. However, there's also evidence that people could have come over from the Pacific Islands, from the Polynesian Islands, mm-hmm. and made it to either side of South America. And it's just, it's not as good of evidence, I guess.
I was going to say, I think that there isn't a lot of evidence for that, which is why it's generally
not a ton,
not considered a good option for how people got to South America.
Does it seem like people would have just hauled ass across two continents? And what reason would there have been?
Well, no.
In all human history, they just sit there and have their little seasonal rounds and you know, kill animals and survive. Why just cruise in a few generations, you know, even a dozen generations, all the way down, you know?
Well, I think
15,000 miles of continents.
Yeah, I don't think that makes sense either. I think that people were probably crossing into North America much earlier than 15,000 years.
Oh, that I mean,
and,
possibly.
And in a wave of migration that we don't have evidence for yet.
Sure.
So we don't know about it. And those are the people that made it all the way down to South America. So it makes it artificially seem like there's only 100 years between the earliest, a few hundred years between the earliest sites in Canada and then the earliest sites in South America. But mm-hmm. it actually could be thousands of years if there's an earlier migration that we just haven't found evidence for yet. And we may never find evidence for it because this is the Arctic, the subarctic that we're talking about. It's places that were potentially under glacier, under ice. Like, there might not be any evidence to find.
Mm-hmm.
So because of those conditions, like,
you
know, I think the only way to really connect it is probably through DNA research, maybe.
Right.
But even that, like, DNA is great for telling you the origin of something, but not when that origin happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that's going to just be a really, really hard connection to make. Now, on the other hand, if there is some kind of boat migration that happened from somewhere into South America, we could definitely find evidence of that if we find the right places to look for it. And it just hasn't happened yet. Not in a way that is like super good, you know?
Right.
So anyway, that's how I feel about it.
Well, it could be. And that's the only thing that really makes sense.
Yeah.
Because
why would they book it from north to south like that quickly? That doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And the only reason we're saying or researchers are saying that it could be a few hundred years is because we have sites that are basically just as old in South America.
Yeah.
So it seems like seems like it didn't take very long, but also the math just doesn't add up. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Yukon does have a few prehistoric sites. The Bluefish Caves are among the most significant. And we briefly talked about the Bluefish Caves because there was a whole representation of them, like a recreation of Bluefish Caves in the Beringia Interpretive Center.
Yeah.
And then like a cross section of their excavation too.
I would say the Bluefish Caves are sort of what inspired us to do this.
Yeah.
This Strat Chat.
Probably.
Series, because we're like, well, that cave is really cool.
Yeah.
We haven't ever talked about it before on this podcast, and it's super significant, but there's also like other cool things going on in the same area. So how do we talk about all of it together? Like, we'll talk about it in stratigraphy.
Yeah. We'll talk about Bluefish and a few other sites here in brief, and then we'll get a lot more on Bluefish in a minute.
Yep.
So Bluefish Caves was excavated from the 1970s to the 1990s. And contain stone tools and fossil bones from around 14,000 years ago. So right as early as you possibly can get.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And some of the bones in the caves are possibly up to 25,000 years old. And that is from marks on them that might indicate butchering. Although this is debated, which we will go into more.
Yeah.
But anytime there's a cut or a mark on a bone,
mm-hmm.
that is where there's always interpretation that comes into play, and you just kind of have to like decide which side you believe, essentially. Yeah.
Another place near an area called Beaver Creek is called the Little John site, and this also dates to about 14,000 years ago and features tools and butchered remains of bison, caribou, elk, and other animals. But no human bones or skeletons from this period have been found in the Yukon.
That's not surprising. 14,000 years ago? I mean, like, that's so, so old for human remains to to be preserved, you know?
It's old for them to be preserved. In a cave environment, you might expect that preservation to actually last. But that being said, I would be interested to know more about burial practices in Siberia. And did people just, like a lot of places around the world, people 100% buried their dead where they slept. Like they would just, you know, in the corner of the hut, in the cave, wherever, right? Just didn't matter. But maybe these guys didn't.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe these sites, these are sites where we found stuff, but they just simply didn't bury the dead there. Or maybe these sites had a different use that wouldn't have been conducive to burial. So,
well, and there's also the like accidental death situation that we could get lucky and find at some point, which we saw some of these. We talked about them in the Yukon Beringia Interpretive Center, but
a little wolf dog.
Yeah. Like where basically like the wolf was covered in rockfall from the cave and just preserved there for, you know, tens of thousands of years. Maybe we'll get lucky and find that with the human remains at some point. But until then, we just have to go on the artifacts that we found.
Yeah, these guys were trying to adapt to all this, and the end of the Ice Age brought about dramatic changes to ecosystems and human cultures as a byproduct. People developed new technologies and broader subsistence strategies, fishing, hunting smaller game, to adapt to the boreal forest that was developing around the world. Which really, the boreal forest is like a band of the same kind of trees and forest area around the northern latitudes.
The sort of forest that supports like small game and large game too, but more small game. So if you want to eat, you have to adapt to that.
Yeah, life became more challenging as the boreal forest supported less game than the steppe tundra, because the steppe tundra is where you get your big herds of animals. But those just don't go through a big massive forest. Ancestors of Yukon's First Nations likely arrived in the Holocene, as we mentioned, in subsequent migration from Northeast Asia, and they are part of the Diné or Athabascan language group.
And over the last 10,000 years, these populations colonized the Yukon, developing cultures and lifestyles based on evolving resources. The bison, caribou, salmon, moose, these populations have ebbed and flowed over time. They've changed and but they have taken advantage of those different populations over all that time.
Yeah, so a little bit more on bluefish before we end the segment. It's a cluster of three small caves in the Yukon, about 54 kilometers southwest of a place called Old Crow. And again, excavations began in the 70s by Jacques Cinq-Mars and continued for decades.
And I think we saw in that little like diorama type thing that they had set up, it was sort of like a cross section of the caves. And you could see the three caves and the way like one steps up to the other, which steps up to the other, essentially. And they did like a kind of a cross section thing. And there were like teeny tiny trowel and like teeny tiny like rope in there. It was so cute.
Yeah, it was kind of neat.
They kind of did a really good job of showing like an archaeological site. But I think they did say that that third cave, the furthest back one, there is potential for more excavation there. I don't know if they're doing it now or if they have a plan for the future, but there is definitely a possibility that more data, more information can come out of this area, which would be great because it's such an old site. We don't have very many of those. Yeah. So, you know, you got to take what you can get where you've got it for sure.
Yeah, the caves did contain animal bones, including extinct horses and mammoths and stone artifacts. There was also bones from fish, birds, small and large mammals of the late Pleistocene, the megafauna, mammoth megafauna era, are also preserved. All of that in the cave.
Yep. And some of those bones show marks that are interpreted as cut marks, which suggests butchering or tool use by humans.
Right.
And that's a pretty good assumption since there are also stone tools there.
Yeah.
Like, what else are you going to use a stone tool for except to, like, you know, cut meat, cut bones?
Yeah, and you might be thinking that how do you know they're cut marks and not like bite marks or something like that? But there's definitely a fairly clear delineation between cutting and biting from pretty much every animal, not just humans. But generally, bite marks have a more U-shaped indentation to them.
Kind of shovel-shaped almost?
Yeah, sort of. They're just not, even if you got sharp pointy fangs, you're not really chewing with those, right? So you're making sort of
trough-shaped gouges
in the bone, whereas cut marks from tools are almost universally like a V shape, because that's how tools cut, you know, stone tools, so you can really tell.
I mean, that's how it is today too, right? Like take a bite take a bite out of like something like a piece of celery, that would be like a good example, right? Because it's kind of long and bone shaped.
Sort of.
Take a bite out of that and look at what your teeth do to it, and then cut the end with a knife, and like you'll see how that
Right. This site also yielded evidence of bone tool production and bone flaking, which is kind of
very interesting.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
Yeah, it takes a big mammal bone to be able to do that.
Yeah, it does. And dense. It's gotta be so dense. I think of bones as being fragile, but not these big old mammoth or mastodon bones.
Yeah, now here's where it gets crazy, and we kind of mentioned this already, but radiocarbon dating of bones with possible cut marks indicates human activity as early as 24,000 years ago. Now, there's a lot that could be wrong with that, but if it's right, it's pretty cool.
I don't know if I just want to believe it or what.
Right.
But it just seems to make sense that there were humans there earlier than we have evidence for so far. We don't need to go into that anymore, but I kind of buy it, but I would love to see better evidence for it, which I know you only have what you have. So it's not the researcher's fault that the evidence is possible cut marks that they're not 100% sure about. But man, I just wish there was better evidence.
Well, and for the longest time, the oldest thing we had was the Clovis culture, we called it.
Yes.
Which is the only culture really that spanned like two continents. It's only because nobody renamed it locally, I feel like. I feel like everything else has been renamed locally. But for some reason, Clovis has one name across two continents.
Yeah.
And
the first one was found in New Mexico. And and that name just stuck across the entire country, I guess, because it's so rare, maybe?
Not just the country, the continent and South America.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So these sites predate Clovis' first model of peopling of the Americas by about 10,000 years, if you believe the 24,000-year-old calibrated radiocarbon date. But also, even if you don't, you're looking at Bluefish Caves of 14,000 and other sites. But there are sites now in Oregon and Montana and other places that well predate Clovis First. And like almost nobody believes in Clovis First
is like that's an old idea that if you are looking in an old textbook, you might see it. But like it's really something that I think is mostly out the door, because as with all things, there probably wasn't just one migration of people. Right.
Yeah.
Even if it was only 15,000 years ago and not earlier than that, there probably wasn't one migration. One of them did bring Clovis technology for sure, or it developed later, and that did spread out across the continents, but there were also other people with other technologies as well.
Right.
Maybe they developed independently. Who knows?
But I don't know.
Yeah.
Bluefish Caves is considered the oldest archaeological site in Canada and one of the earliest in North America. That is not in dispute.
No.
The main point of the debate, however, is the bone modifications. Are they of human origin? Could they have been caused by natural processes? For example, carnivore gnawing, trampling, you know, who knows what, but could they have been caused by natural processes?
Yeah.
And critics have long dismissed Sinkmars, the guy who originally excavated this, his claims, and the critics argued that the marks could actually be natural, but critics always argue that. I'm like, who are these critics? They're sitting over there. Just being all curmudgeon-y.
They're like
on the porch and they're saying, get off my lawn. Stop moving my trash can. And those marks aren't natural.
You know who I always think of are the two puppets from the Muppet Show that are up in the
Muppets
theater.
From the Muppet Show. They're not puppets.
The Muppet. I know, I'm so bad. But you know who I'm talking about? The two old guys that sit up in the theater box. Yeah, just like making snide comments. Those are the critics here.
Those are definitely the critics.
I understand wanting evidence and wanting hard evidence, for sure. I do. And I think it is right to be critical of this stuff. But I don't think that dismissing it entirely is the right move either. You know, just request more evidence. That's all.
More recent taphonomic and microscopic analysis supports the human origin of at least some of the marks, strengthening the argument for very early human presence. And taphonomic analysis, by the way, is basically just the study of, or the idea of, what happens to a bone after an animal dies.
That's
taphonomy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It could be fossilization. It could be eating by other animals. It could be deterioration into the ground. But the taphonomy of something is what happens to its bones after it dies.
Right.
Yeah. So the findings suggest Beringian hunters used the caves as temporary shelters or butchering sites during the last glacial maximum.
Makes sense. Why wouldn't you want to be in a cave?
I know. Yeah. So.
The Bluefish Caves provide evidence for a Beringian standstill, in quotations, hypothesis. And what they're saying with that is humans may have lived in Beringia for thousands of years before moving south into the Americas. Mm-hmm. See, now I like that idea, too, because, you know, it does. And like maybe you're wondering why they booked it south in a couple hundred years, but maybe like a route finally opened up that gave access to the southern area in an easier way or something like that. And people were just like,
the ice-free corridor.
Well, yeah, there's that. But like, you still need to pass through that corridor to get south. And it's like, I mean, maybe one year, one season, something opened up in the right direction and people are like, whoa, look at all those animals. Let's go, go, go. And like, just like followed them all the way down. And like, you know, four or five, six generations later, you know, they're in that site in South America. That's way at the southern end. I can't remember what it's called right now.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. Cut all this out. It's fine. You're probably not going to cut it out, are you? Just gonna leave it in.
I'm just staring at her.
Just going to keep talking.
All staying in.
This is probably like a 25 minute segment, so we should probably wrap it up.
What is that site called?
You know what I'm talking about.
Monteverde?
No.
That we should probably look that up.
I'm going to look it up right now.
Anyway, we'll have that for you at the beginning of segment three, because at the beginning of segment three, you know, while people are trying to head into this area and, you know, live here and make a living, in segment three, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of crazy bastards that ran to this area for a very short period of time.
Yep.
All right. Back in a minute. This next segment is just pure gold.
Oh, that was so good.
Welcome back to Strat Chat.
Why does it have to be like an NPR, you know, like announcer from the 90s? I feel like that's the vibe you're going for.
Hello, Rachel. What next would you like to talk about on Strat Chat?
Oh, man.
All right. So the next thing. Oh, well, first we have a verification, not a correction.
Verification, not, yeah. Good job. You pulled it out of the depths of your brain somewhere. The name of the site in South America that we're talking about is Monteverde in Chile. Yeah. So, yeah. And that one, just really quick, because it's just cool to know, but evidence suggests humans lived there at least 14,500 years ago, which is only 500 years after what we're talking about in Canada. So that is kind of booking it for people.
But that's because these guys up here heard there were tacos. They were tired of caribou meat.
I don't know that there's tacos in Chile.
There's tacos all the way to Chile.
I'm sorry to all the Mexicans out there. I apologize. Your food is delicious. My husband is not.
I am delicious. All right. So the next thing we are going to talk about, because this is Strat Chat, and we don't want to downplay 14,000 years of First Nations history here.
No.
There's a lot that we could talk about, but we wanted to talk, because this is Strat Chat, about something completely different.
Yes.
And
it's really cool to see the variation in people that occupy the same place and that occupy it for totally different reasons, right? Like the whole reason that the first peoples came through the Yukon in this area was for resources, right? Mm-hmm. They're following resources. They're doing the thing that people 14, 15,000 years ago were doing.
Right.
Trying to eat and stay alive. Well, the people we're about to talk about.
Well,
they wanted to eat for sure.
They wanted to eat well.
They wanted to stay alive also for sure. Many didn't.
Right. All right. So what we're talking about here. So pre-1896 in the Yukon, basically European and American traders and prospectors began exploring the region in the mid-19th century. So that's pre-1896, mid-19th century. So, you know, mid-1800s, people start arriving and they're like, okay, there could be some fur trading stuff up here. Let's start figuring that out, right?
Yeah, for sure. And it was really cool. One of the places that we stopped at once we got into Alaska was a little town called Delta Junction, which is basically the end of the Alaska Highway. And there's a super old cabin there that they still have set up. Set up-ish.
More of a museum now.
Yeah, as what it would have looked like in this time period in the end of the 1800s, it was like a lodging facility for boarders that would come through and need a place to stay for a night or two on their way to anywhere in Alaska. And in this case, I'm not sure it was necessarily related exactly to what we're talking about now, but that did happen a lot up here, is that there would be people that were in the fur trade or prospectors or whatever, you know, and they would stay at these kind of cabin situations.
Well, on August 16th, 1896, gold was discovered by George Carmack, Skookum Jim Mason, and Dawson Charlie. And this was at Bonanza Creek and then Rabbit Creek near the Bonanza Creek, I think, was then called Rabbit Creek. It was unclear how that was written near the Klondike River.
Yeah.
So they found gold.
Yep.
And that event marks the official start of what became known as the Klondike Gold Rush.
Yeah.
Yes. And then literally 2 months later, the Discovery Channel started Gold Rush Alaska. Did you know that? Yeah. They're like, we got to get on this. Yeah. So Anyway, now we're at season 942 of Gold Rush Alaska.
Where they found like one nugget or something.
Yeah, they still haven't found a nugget, but they still have cranky old men running excavators, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, late 1896, so the rest of that year and early into 1897, news spreads slowly of this find. I mean, I can only imagine because, you know, August is starting to get into winter up here.
Yeah.
In some areas, you know. You got up there near the Klondike River in the northern Yukon. I mean, it's got to be like starting to get real up there.
It's not the right time to come north, really. It's not. Yeah. And getting to this area is really, really difficult in the late 1800s. You know, there's the water route, you know, where they came in somewhere in Alaska and then, you know, hiked all the way to the Klondike area in the Yukon. Or they could have come up one of the trails from the south, but man, that was a treacherous idea. That would have been quite a journey to come that direction. So yeah.
Well, initial gold finds were obviously kept relatively quiet as prospectors staked their claims, but prospectors be prospectors and word got out.
Word always gets out. Yeah.
Local miners in Alaska and the Yukon began moving toward the Klondike.
Yeah.
But July of 1897, so just under a year later, the gold rush goes global.
Yeah. And this is what I was talking about, but the steamships Excelsior from San Francisco and Portland from Seattle, they arrived.
Which is
weird. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's your two big ports on the West Coast at that time,
I know,
right?
You call your steamship Portland and it's out of Seattle.
Oh, yeah. That is weird. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But go ahead.
But anyway, they arrived in, I think, the Skagway area of Alaska to basically drop off the hordes of miners or potential miners, hopeful miners, let's call them, to disembark there and start their route up to the Klondike area. And I looked up that a little bit because I was like, why in the world would they go to Skagway? But like, they just didn't really have another option.
Yeah.
Skagway was the closest they could get on land to, you know, by ship. It's the closest they could disembark to the gold rush and then have the,
without coming all the way up through Canada.
Yeah. Basically. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause they could probably do it in a few days, just like you can today.
Yeah.
It could have been a week, but those steamships, they were moving.
Oh yeah. The steamships. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. They could do it. I thought you meant on land. They could do it in a day or two. I'm
not
like, no,
back then.
it
could have taken months back then.
It could have taken months. Yeah. It probably did take months for sure. Yeah.
It took us a month.
Well, we were going slow on purpose, but
true.
Yeah.
But newspaper headlines proclaiming gold, gold, gold sparked a mass migration.
Yeah.
Yep. Headed up there. So from 1897 to 1898, the next year, basically called the Stampede Period.
Yeah.
An estimated 100,000 people set out for the Klondike. And about 30,000 to 40,000 actually made it.
That is so crazy, right? That is so super crazy.
It's not like they died. No, they just gave up. It was too hard.
Yeah. Well, and that, again, it reminds me of some of the stuff we were reading in that little cabin that we went to, how like a lot of these, I guess, homesteaders, you could call them, or pioneers, gold rushers, prospectors, whatever their goal was, like they might have had a certain goal in their mind when they started out, but those goals quickly shifted and changed based on the environment and where they were and who they interacted with. And they would, I think one of the ways people survived there was shifting and like adapting to what they were experiencing in the moment. So people probably stopped, you know, chasing gold to, you know, open a boarding house or maybe they're like, oh, there's not enough donkeys to carry supplies here. I'm going to start supplying donkeys to these guys. And that's going to help. That's how I'm going to make my millions, you know? So I think a lot of that happened.
My thousands. So two of the main routes were the Chilkoot Trail and the White Pass Trail from Alaska into the Yukon.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chilkoot Trail is famous for the Golden Stairs, which was a steep climb with prospectors hauling a ton of supplies.
That's so crazy.
Stairs. Yeah. Not real stairs, but White Pass Trail, known as the Dead Horse Trail, because they're always very clever like that. due to the number of pack animals that died, they're just like, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right, right. Yeah.
In 1898, Dawson City boomed. And Dawson City is northwest of Whitehorse, really, We didn't go up there. We went through Dawson Creek. Getting very confused by that. All the navigation.
Dawson Creek is way on the other side.
Way down in
British Columbia, not Yukon, too.
And that's the start of the Alaska-Canada Highway, actually.
It is, that's where we started.
Yep, starts in Dawson Creek and ends in Delta Junction, Alaska.
Yes.
But Dawson City was founded and exploded from a handful of buildings into a city of 30,000 people. Any gold rush town you hear about.
Or
mining town or whatever.
And we've heard about this a lot because, like, it happened in Nevada, too, with the various different gold rushes or silver rushes, whatever you want to call them, that happened back then, too.
Yep. The city became the heart of the gold rush with saloons, of course, dance halls and businesses catering to miners. Mm-hmm. 1898 to 1899 is the peak and decline of this whole thing. I mean, this is literally just 2 to 3 years later.
Yeah.
The most accessible gold claims are quickly staked and mined. They're played out.
Yep.
Many late arrivals find little gold left.
Yeah.
Or at least a little easy gold left.
And there was news of gold discoveries in Nome, Alaska in 1899. So, you know, just a couple of years later. And that, I mean, these guys, they were just gold chasing, right? Mm-hmm. So it just led to a mass exodus from the Klondike area to the Nome, Alaska area, which would have probably been even harder to get to, honestly.
I was thinking about that. Nome is almost impossible to get to right now. You have to basically fly or take a boat there.
Yep.
There's no road that goes there.
There's no road.
Yeah. So, but back then there were no roads anyway. So would it have been that much harder to get to? Really? I mean, probably, it was further out.
I assume they would have taken a ship at that time, but
it would have been easier.
Riding over the land would be very challenging.
Very challenging.
Yeah. But
so post 1899, the aftermath of this whole thing, Dawson City's population basically declines to nothing rapidly.
Yeah.
Some miners remain and continue to work claims with more advanced techniques. So that's what happens with gold, though. You can continue to mine. And in fact, modern gold mines have gone through historic gold mines because the tailings,
they have gold
contained microscopic gold, which we can get out now. And it's still valuable.
Which is so crazy. They didn't have the technology.
Yeah.
Or maybe the technology, the cost of using the technology outweighed the amount of gold that they were going to get out of the tailings 100 years ago. So they didn't bother putting the effort into it. But now everything is cheaper, right? Yep. It's more efficient. It's faster. It's cheaper. So that's why modern mining operations will go to old gold mines.
Yeah. The gold rush left a lasting impact on the Yukon's infrastructure, demographics, and folklore. Mm-hmm. And the Klondike Gold Rush is immortalized in literature. Jack London's Call of the Wild, Robert Service's poems. Those were what I read in the notes. But of course, who do you know? Yukon Cornelius.
Oh, Yukon Cornelius.
He throws up his axe, his pickaxe. It comes down, licks it. Nothing.
Yeah.
He's just looking for gold.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I love it.
That's from the Rudolph movie.
You know what I always think about? There's a show, a miniseries that we watched from about 10 years ago called Klondike.
Oh.
And I definitely watched it. I think you watched it with me. I'm not sure. But it has one of the Stark brothers from Game of Thrones, the older one. And he plays one of the prospectors, you know. But I'll never forget this scene in the movie where they're basically just hauling equipment up a snowy mountain. And I'm pretty sure that is the Chilkoot Trail.
Sure.
Like that, where you get to Skagway on a boat, and then you have to haul all of the stuff that you need in order to mine gold up actual mountains that are covered in snow to get to the Klondike area. It's insane that so many people were willing to make the trek and take the chance on gold, and so many of them never even saw even an ounce of gold.
Was that show about the Klondike Gold Rush, or was it later?
It was about the Klondike Gold Rush. It's called Klondike.
Man, I do not remember that at all.
Maybe I watched it without you. I don't remember. But it was 2014. I'm looking at it here on IMDb. And it's two guys that go together to search for gold, basically. Okay. Yeah.
But now I want to watch it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It was just one little mini series, like one season. And it just follows the two guys.
Well, sites like Dawson City and the Chilkoot Trail are now preserved as historic sites and parks. And in fact, in doing the research for this, some of our links are actually from the Park Service in Canada and the United States, because the Klondike National Historic Park an international historic park. There's an international historic park that's like a joint effort between mm-hmm. the U.S. and Canada to manage this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Seattle unit for one of these. And I know that if we somehow miss all this on the way back down, I definitely want to go see what the Seattle unit has to say.
Yeah, because you know? The U.S. side up here is in Skagway.
Yeah.
Which, for those that aren't familiar with Alaska geography, I'm only recently familiar with it. But to get to Skagway, you actually have to leave the larger part of Alaska. There's no way to drive through Alaska to get to Skagway. You have to leave it, go through the Yukon, and then you take there's a road that goes south and in the Yukon, and then you take that to get over to Skagway, because Skagway is kind of on the little tail of Alaska that goes off to the south. So it's a journey that we may or may not have time to make on our way out of here. We're not sure yet, but yeah, it would be cool if we got to, but and that trail too, if you have any desire to, you know, experience what the Gold Rush people experience, you can apply for an international permit, because it crosses the international border. So you have to get a joint U.S.-Canada backpacking permit, and then you can hike the, I think, like 35 mile trail from the U.S. side to the Canadian side, or vice versa, and do exactly what those miners did. You could even haul mining gear with you if you wanted to gold pan or something, but I don't know if I recommend doing that. That would not be so fun.
All right, then.
Yeah.
Well, what did you think of our first episode of Stretch Hat?
It was good. It's just very interesting to look at the same place, but people who occupied that place at very different times, with very different goals, who wanted something so different out of the land. Like, these Klondike gold rushers were, you know, they're just like, they're there on a hope and a prayer that they might, you know, strike gold, you know, and it's like a form of gambling, basically.
Yeah.
And they didn't need to be there. They didn't go there to survive. They didn't have to be there, but they did it on the possibility that they can make a whole bunch of money.
On the possibility.
Yeah. Whereas the Native Americans, or the Native peoples, indigenous peoples, they were just like surviving. They were just living and surviving, just moving across the landscape.
Well, they were on an elk rush.
Well, yeah, following game or, you know, whatever resources they were interested in, in finding. So just like the motivations are just so different, but it happened in the same exact area. I don't know how close Bluefish Caves are to the Klondike area, but I think they're quite close together. So, yeah.
Who was the first person that found gold and didn't just chuck it away because it was useless, but gold or silver or some sort of shiny metal? They're not even like that impressive when you first find them. They almost have to be processed. But who was the first person that found that and said, you know, hey, I'll give you this, but I want a lot for it.
Yeah.
And somebody else was like, you know what? I really, really want that. I give
really
you
want
a lot
that shiny thing.
Yeah.
It only has the value that humans place on it, right?
Exactly.
Otherwise, how it is just with a rock. All gemstones and all material like that. It's just whatever we decide as a human species, like what it's worth together, which is just crazy when you think about it.
Yep. All right. Well, that's it for this episode of Stretch It.
Gotta stop saying it like that. I'm gonna ban that. we want to hear where are you guys interested in hearing us do a Stretch Hat episode? I mean, we've definitely got like England on the brain with, you know, the Roman occupation and then the earlier stuff, and of course like blah, later medieval
blah,
stuff.
Blah, sorry.
No, I love it. I super love it. There's been so many, like, we would have to pick and choose the strats.
No,
there's been so much occupation
Stonehenge,
in that area.
England, the Queen.
No.
I don't know.
Those aren't even strats. What are you even talking about?
Yeah, they are.
But like Italy might be another good one. I feel like maybe Africa, because we could get into like the really, really old, like pre-human stuff.
But Africa, like as a continent, can't be one.
No, not the continent, but like different areas around Africa. So anyway, there's lots of cool areas we can explore from a stratigraphy standpoint.
All right. Well, we're going to explore the end of this episode now because it's gone way too long.
Yeah, probably.
All right.
We talk a lot.
Yep. All right. See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Seabrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.